Okay, today's topic is coordinate systems and global grids, and I'll distinguish between the two. Global grids should apply to the entire planet. We've already met one system, latitude and longitude, that does that. But we can still have coordinate systems with reasonably local extent, which are not necessarily global, but they work. So let me begin by introducing why we need coordinate systems. So you should all recognize the road leading to Paris, right? Perhaps not the Paris you expected, Paris, France, but Paris, Texas. A little bit different. So the use of popular place names, what cartographers call toponyms, is very useful. It's how we address letters. It's how we talk about, you know, I'm going to Santa Barbara, I'm going to Los Angeles, whatever. But the names are not always unique, so we can have the same place name in different locations. London, Ontario, and London, England, Paris, Texas, Paris, France. And they're not always specific. So London can mean the city of London, a single dot in a Google Maps view of London, the entire London metropolitan area. Most people think of it these days as all of southeastern England. So it's not specific in terms of a location. So a coordinate system, this is going to solve this problem. It's a standardized method for assigning codes to locations so that the locations can be found using the codes alone. And these days that usually means cut and paste them into a mapping program and bang, you go straight there. But it also works for your cell phone and those sorts of things. Okay, standardized coordinate systems use absolute locations and allow accuracy to be set or varied. So absolute means that they're going to be with reference to given places that are known, like the Greenwich Meridian or like the equator. And the variable accuracy means that we should be able to specify, you know, how precisely we need to measure something. Do we want to measure it down to the millimeter, the centimeter? Is 10 meters enough? Is the nearest kilometer good enough? So a map captured in the units of a paper sheet, so if we sort of simply cut up a map into an 8.5 by 11 piece, put it down on a scanner and scanned it, then the units on the scan would be in like inches or millimeters of on paper. They're not the same as the coordinates on the map that relate to the real Earth. So we distinguish between coordinate systems that are relative to the map and coordinate systems that are relative to the Earth. And almost exclusively, we want to work with coordinate systems that are referenced to the real Earth, not just a map of the Earth. And in a coordinate system, almost uniformly, standardized coordinate systems call X eastings and Y northings. So we've got our own name for X and Y in cartography. And usually, we fix things so that the zero point is way off to the left and way below anything we're going to map, which means that both the eastings and the northings are always positive numbers. We're not going to deal with negative values the way we do when we deal with X and Y in Cartesian geometry. Okay, so most maps have some kind of simple coordinate system embedded within them. This is one I found on the web for the city of Cairo. There's Zamalek up there. And here we've just simply taken this direction, the Y direction, we've drawn off a grid. It looks like they're in units of 100 meters or so, and we've simply numbered them 0 through 14, and then we've done the same thing. This way, we've lettered them off. So we might talk about, you know, G12 is where you'll find a particular street intersection. And if you look in the index on the map, that's how the coordinate referencing is going to be done. You know, go to a particular shop or a particular monument, you'd go, it'll tell you which part of the map to search. So this is a grid system, but it's not particularly advantageous because it only works for this particular map. So what we'd like is standard systems that work for any map, i.e. anywhere in the Earth, ideally, so they can avoid confusion among cities. Different cities might have different grids of different types, different size grid cells. Different map producers, different agencies might use letters one way and numbers the other way, so you get complete confusion if two people had the same, or had slightly different guides to a city and the lettering system was different. You'd be talking about grid K13 and it's in a completely different place. So we'd need comparable size locations. what we would like is systems to be terse. That means we want them to be really short, sharp, and to the point. So we'd like to have our geocodes, or our reference codes, our coordinates, be as short as possible. You know, these days, people's URLs on the internet are getting so long that there are services that will sell you much shorter names, like tinyurl.com, and allow you to condense your long URL into something much shorter so that you can actually type it on your phone without having to hit too many of those little keys that I can never hit very well on my phone. So short is good. It should have authority, so it should be a recognized system of some kind, not just one you made up overnight in your dorm room. It should work when other reference systems fail, and yes, other reference systems do fail. I'll show you some examples in a minute. And it can be used in positioning systems. So ideally, it's some kind of system that I can type into my navigation system or into Google Earth or Google Maps or my cell phone, and it's going to actually take me to the place where I want to go. That would be a real advantage. Why are place references in absolute terms necessary? Well, the things on the Earth, in spite of how permanent we like to think of them, are temporary and transient. Landslides take things away, floods destroy neighborhoods. If all the roads disappear and most of the buildings, in the case of the Lower Ninth Ward in 2005, pretty much everything, how do you navigate your way around? You know, when sort of your mental map has disappeared, you see that the first thing somebody's done is just spray painted the street names on this light pole so that people can begin to find their way around again. Much better if I've got some kind of permanent navigation device that's always going to work, regardless of the conditions, the weather, whether it's day or night, or I'm in a flood or not. Coordinates become essential, absolutely essential, when we have no landmarks at all. Nothing on the landscape to help us navigate by any way, means, or form. And enormous parts of the Earth are exactly like this, the tundras of Canada. Antarctica, you know, the just enormous land masses with relatively no features, and then of course the almost 3/4 of the Earth that's covered in sea. If we're out there in the middle of nowhere, one piece of water looks pretty much like any other piece of water, and if you don't have some navigation system that uses coordinates, you can be in real trouble. Okay, we've already met geographic coordinates, and we've learned already that coordinates make a difference. The reference frame makes a difference. If you change the datum from the one that was in use when in 1874 when they standardized the Greenwich Meridian, and you change it to WGS84, you move the reference datum 104 meters, and you confuse German, or were they Dutch tourists, quite a bit when they've got their GPS receivers. Now, geographic coordinates, notice that we have to reference an ellipsoid. So here is a particular set of coordinates. In this case, we use the Clark 1866 ellipsoid, no relative. That's Alexander Russ Clark, famous geodesist and cartographer and Navy guy from a long time ago. But he gave us a reference ellipsoid that happened to be used in mapping the United States. So the NAD-27 was based on the Clark 1866 ellipsoid. And here we've got two places. I've actually used them in class before. We have this antenna up on the mesa on the other side of campus that you can see from Goleta Beach. I use the center of that circle and the little loop here on Campus Point. So there's the surf break right there, and that's where you can actually stand on Campus Point. So here are two locations. And you'll see latitudes and longitudes, the way we actually write the numbers, done in several different ways. Here we can sort of guess that that's 32 degrees, 24 minutes, 20.83000 seconds north, 119 degrees, 50 minutes, 39.93000 seconds west. That pretty much puts us in the right location. Obviously, these two places are slightly different from each other. You can see a whole minute difference there. Same over here. So they're separated from each other in both latitude and longitude in these two locations. But let's think about those numbers for a minute, see if they make sense. I got these right out of Google Earth. Google Earth will stream the coordinates and show them down here in the bottom of the screen. And you notice that we have, let me see, 5 decimal places of seconds on these coordinates. So does that make sense to have 5 decimal places of seconds? Well, we've already learned that the degree of longitude at the equator, and also degree of latitude at the equator, is approximately 111,111 meters, one of those magic numbers I've already given you to memorize and burnish onto your brain forever. So a degree is 60 minutes, and each minute is 60 seconds, so a degree is 3,600 seconds, just like an hour is 3,600 seconds. So if we simply do the division there, we can figure out that a single second is 30.86 meters. 1 second. If we go to a tenth of a second, that's the first decimal place of seconds, we're down to 3.09 meters. That's about it's about from here to the end of the screen, maybe a little bit less. If we go to the hundredth, that's the next decimal place, we're up to 3.31 meters. That's almost exactly a foot. It's like about that long. So in the thousandths, we're up to 3.1 centimeters. Okay, not very far at all. So it makes sense to have accuracies, or rather precisions, reported that are meaningful in terms of our abilities to navigate or even use these. So Google Earth, in this case, when we zoom in on the tower, gives us lats and longs here to 2 decimal places, or hundredths of a second, which if we go back to our slide before, we can see is 0.31, about a third of a meter. So that's sort of reasonable. Wow, that's impressive. Look at that. How to publicize your event. I didn't set this up. Okay, so that's honestly the first time that's ever happened to me. Okay. So why not just use geographic coordinates? It's a really effective system. It works. It seems to be precise. As long as we specify the ellipsoid, it can be quite accurate. As long as we give somebody pop the balloons or something. If as long as we specify to a reasonable degree of accuracy, we can use it. So here's a particularly famous instance of this is now almost 25 years ago when Peter Gould, a geographer who's since deceased, was working with our own Waldo Tobler here at UC Santa Barbara. And I don't know if it was a bet, but they did some experiments that are documented on the website for CSIS, where they just simply addressed postcards sent from all over the world to Professor Waldo Tobler and a latitude and a longitude. And this is correctly specified, does indeed refer to the right location. So they mailed not only postcards but also letters all over the world to see how many would make it back. And there's some really interesting stories. One in particular got sent to, I think it was 3 different continents, and got stamped, you know, not known at this address, sent on to the next one. You read the story on the website, it's kind of fun. It's not very effective, probably not very precise. So, we're going to look at some coordinate systems in this class. I feel that we should learn a few of them so that we get them down pat. And we're going to look at the following, but bear in mind that these are not the only ones. There are a great many more. We're going to look at 4 today, but as you'll see, 3 of those 4, or even sort of almost 3.5 of the 4, are pretty much identical with slight variance, and we need to learn those variants. The last one is the state plane coordinate system. That is quite different, even though part of it's based on the transverse Mercator. And then we're going to learn another system, but it's not standardized, and it doesn't really refer to points. It refers to rectangles. And that's the United States Public Land Survey System, and that's coming in Friday's lecture. Okay. So the ones we're going to concentrate on are the Universal Transverse Mercator System. That's the civilian version of it, and I include that because it's stamped on all of the United States Geological Survey's maps. So once we understand it, here's another one. Look, it's incredible. Somebody set this up. This is really pretty good. I could use this in class again. We're going to look at the Military Grid Reference System, or the MGRS, which, as we'll see, is very similar. And we're going to look at the national grid, which I can let the cat out of the bag now and tell you that it, wow, look at the air circulation pattern. That's cool. I can tell you right now that the national grid is the exactly the same as the military grid, except for the datum. So that's the only difference you need to know. So we'll start with UTM, and we looked at map projections last time. And we, in fact, I sort of set it up by saying we can have transverse projections. Remember, transverse projections is where we take the normal equatorial setting of the projection and we instead turn it around so that the central meridian, or the line of no distortion, goes from one pole to the other. In fact, we can then continue and do the other side of the Earth as well on the same projection. But we saw that the Mercator projection is quite useful. It's conformal, so it preserves shape and local direction, which is what we would like to have preserved if we're going to deal with X and Y. We'd like our directions to be preserved. It's not quite equal area, but we'll deal with that as we get to it. The nice thing about the transverse Mercator projection is that distortion is minimized along the central meridian that goes from pole to pole. I'm not going to cover this in detail, but there's a handy-dandy little trick that makes the projection secant rather than tangent along the central meridian. And it's really simple. You just take the central meridian itself and then multiply all the scaling constants along the central meridian by a value very, very close to 1, just slightly less than 1, 0.9996. And that's the equivalent of having two standard parallels running down, well, not parallels, but standard lines running down on either side of the central meridian. I'll show you why that is advantageous in a minute. Then we just simply keep drawing the projection over and over again. We do it 60 times to cover the entire Earth, and we call these things zones. So we have transverse Mercator zones, and then we extend the projection from 84 degrees north to 80 degrees south. And the reason for that is that 84 degrees north, we go a little bit further because there are actually quite a lot of islands surrounding the Arctic Ocean, but we have an Antarctic continent. So when we get down to the south, we've got land. North, we've got water and islands. But if we go to 80 south, we almost get the entire coastline of Antarctica, but we miss out a little bit by the Ross Ice Shelf. Okay, and we are going to deal with the poles separately. We're going to use another projection for that called the Universal Polar Stereographic, whose name was stolen by a delivery company. Okay, this gives us the Earth 60 times for each zone. So this is zone 11. I drew this yesterday for class. Each of them is going to be 6 degrees wide. It's going to extend from 80 degrees south, putting us right here in Antarctica, up to 80 degrees north, way up north of the Baffin Islands and up there and so on. But they're relatively skinny. I chose this one, zone 11, because we're pretty close to the boundary between zones 10 and 11 right here. So if these are 6 degrees wide, let's see. If we start we start at the 180th meridian and call that zone number 1. So zone number 1 would extend from 180 degrees west to 174 degrees west, and its central meridian would be at 177 degrees west. Okay, so this is zone 11, extends from 114 degrees west out to 120 degrees west, and its central meridian would be 117 degrees west. Okay. When we change and make the secant, we actually have the equivalent of putting two lines of zero distortion that run a little bit apart from each other the entire length. And that controls the amount of distortion error in the projection, so it's never more than one part in 2,500. So remember, we can't have exact equal area properties because this is a conformal, not an equal area projection. So we're going to distort area, but we're going to minimize the distortion of error by first drawing the world 60 times and then secondly making each one of these secant rather than tangent. Okay? And here's one designation of the UTM zones, all right? So we start over here at zone 1, the 180th meridian. We just simply increase the number. Here we are at zones 10 and 11. That's where we are in Southern California. Actually, 10 and 11 cover almost all of California. One day I'm going to fall flat on my face because of this thing. Okay, so when we get to the Greenwich Meridian, where are we? 60 zones, halfway around the world, would be zone 30. And sure enough, there it is, zone 30, 31. And when we get all the way back to the same point, because remember this line is exactly the same as that line over there, we're in zone 60. So those zones cover the entire Earth. Notice that I've got two little circles, one here and one up there. Those are the universal polar stereographic projections that we're going to use for our separate UPS system. Okay, ignore the rest of this for now. There's actually another grid system on here, but I'm not going to talk about it until we finish the civilian version. Here's a slightly prettier map. Makes it a little bit more legible. You can see the zones numbered off. You can also see this other numbering system that I'm not going to talk about, but I wanted to include this to say that nothing's perfect. These are operational, so they decided that right up there north of Norway and around Svalbard and all those wonderful places north of Britain, there are some skinny zones and some fat zones, and there are only a few exceptions, like four or five. For all intents and purposes, you can pretty much ignore them. I don't think you're going to spend much time on a submarine underneath the Arctic Ocean. This is the part of the system we deal with most of the time. Notice that because we start the numbering on the 180th meridian and we increase as we go east, by the time we reach the United States, or at least the lower 48, we're in zone 10. There's the 10-11 boundary I was just talking about. 12, 14, 15 as we go through the center of the country, 18, and Maine is entirely within 19, and then we drop off and we're over the Atlantic heading towards Britain and the 30th zone. Now, we're very close to a zone boundary, and I'll throw out a challenge here. I won't give any extra credit for it, but if anybody's into the sport of geocaching, who doesn't know what geocaching is? All right, you will know in a few weeks, but if you're into the sport of geocaching, here is a geocache that we hid when we constructed this monument to commemorate the opening of our spatial center over in Phelps Hall. This is in, I believe it was in 2008. In May, here's Mike Goodchild with the plaque that we had built. We got out top of the line GPS equipment and measured the exact location of the 120th meridian, which is also the boundary between zones 10 and 11, which passes through not very far from here, just up before you get to Gaviota. And there's the monument set in the ground, and there's me holding the 120 degrees west marker to prove that you are two-thirds of the way around the world, or one-third of the way around the world, depending on which direction you're going. So what's an example of this first coordinate system? I just realized I'd taken out a rather important slide. Did I put it back in again? No. So let's go back to this one and discuss how we're going to turn this into a grid system. Okay, well, it's fairly straightforward. One thing to remember is that we already know some of these distances. If we actually started numbering at the pole, and notice that we don't, we start at 80 south, and went up to the equator, that distance is 10 million meters, okay, one quarter of the way around the Earth. That was the definition of the meter to begin with. So if we start numbering again at the equator and go up to the North Pole, we would once again be at 10 million. So the first thing we have to do, other than give the zone number for a designation, so we would say zone 11, would be to say whether we're in the northern or the southern hemisphere. So let's say we're in the northern hemisphere. So if we talk about here, we're going to be in 11 north, or 11N, we usually abbreviate, just put the N. Okay, now we need an easting and a northing associated with that. The northing is easy. We have two zero reference points, the South Pole and the equator, and we just count in meters. Okay, so we might be right here, we're in the third, between the third and fourth millions of meters in terms of our northing. So all we need now is eastings. That's an X, the X value in the system. And for that, what we do is we set a... we take the central meridian for the zone, which is a straight line and crosses the equator at 90 degrees exactly, and we call the easting for that central meridian 500,000. Okay, so that sets the zero point for the zone about a half a degree of longitude outside of our zone. So that means that if we've got an area that just slightly overlaps two zones, we can sort of fudge it and allow part of it to be still counting within the zone. Okay? So we continue counting off until we get to the edge of the zone, or slightly over the edge of the zone, which is, if the center is 500,000, the edge is about a million. So we're going to have Eastings that are, generally speaking, in the hundreds of thousands, and certainly less than a million. We're going to have Northings that are going to be around this part of the world in the millions. We also need to give the zone number and the hemisphere. Okay, so let's get back to where I was. Make a mental note to myself to put that slide back in again. So here's our first coordinate system other than latitude and longitude. Okay, it's the location of I believe it's that point right there in the middle of the circle. I haven't measured it with GPS, I did it right off of Google Earth. And then translated, so we get 239,305 meters east. East of what? Well, east of the arbitrary zero point for the particular zone that we're in, zone 11, northern hemisphere. 3,810,798 meters north. North of what? Well, north of the equator, because we start the counting at the south pole for the southern hemisphere and at the equator for the northern hemisphere. Okay? Six digits plus seven digits plus two more plus some letters, and we can locate any place on Earth to within 1 meter. Okay, that's a very terse, very effective system. But of course, we still need to specify the ellipsoid that we use, because as we know, there can be quite significant differences, hundreds of meters, as we go from reference ellipsoid to reference ellipsoid. So here's the first system we've met. And why have I bothered to go over this? Well, it's marked on all the maps that we have of the United States. Okay, this is an enormous enlargement of the bottom left-hand corner of a topographic map. Okay, and we're going to access these online and use them in the labs. But take a look up there. We've got the corner of the map itself. And interestingly enough, we can see a little tick mark there. See three dashes? The difference between that corner and the little tick mark is because of differences in datum. So the differences in datum shifts. As it says, the values of the shift between NAD 27 and NAD 83 for 7.5 minute intersections shown by those dashed corner ticks there, NAD 83. Okay, let's read off all the stuff here now, because we all know and understand what it means after these two lectures. It's, first, we've got some lineage information telling us about the map and when it was produced. Notice it's already 22 years out of date. The North American datum of 1927, NAD 27. We heard about that last time. It's based on the Clark 1866 ellipsoid. Projection and 10,000-foot tick marks, California coordinate system zone 5. Forget that for now. We'll meet that by the end of class. Blue, 1,000-meter universal transverse Mercator ticks, zone 11. Okay, so we're going to be in NAD 83. And you see the blue tick marks up there? Those are showing us 1 kilometer units going off in the UTM system. Okay, so what we've actually got are, there's a little 2 and then a big 36, and we'll learn in a minute why that two is little. So that would be 236,000 meters. And here's a little 2 and a big 37, that would be 237,000 meters, so it's 1,000 meters between here and here on the map. If I take the blue lines, that's 1 kilometer on the map. And if I take any point on the map, now I can find its coordinates in UTM. Okay, I got enough information about the datum. I'm told that it's the zone 11, and now I've got a grid on the map so that I can calculate locations on that particular map. Okay, that's UTM. Works quite well. You can program your GPS receiver to give you values in civilian UTM if you like. But there's an alternative system called the military grid. The military always has to do things differently, of course. And the military decided that the civilian system involved enormous large numbers, and your average GI can't deal with any number larger than 10. So, you know, if they can reduce things down a little bit and make it simpler. The other advantage is that if you're repeating long strings of numbers over a radio, or even just typing them in, you're much more prone to make a mistake. If you mix letters and numbers together, people are a little bit better at getting things right, because you can use, you know, like Charlie Whiskey Tango and so on for letters rather than for the numbers. So if you remember that division, they keep the world divided up into the exact same zones, numbered off numerically, so here's zone 11, 12, 13, 14, and so on. But after that point, they begin to divide the Earth up into blocks north-south by 6-degree increments. Okay, so we have 6-degree chunks here, and we simply letter those chunks off. We start, we use A and B for the South Pole, for the UPS designations on the South Pole. So then we start with C, D, E, F, G, H. Now I is confusable with the number 1, so they leave it out. J, K, L, M, N. O is confusable with the number 0, so they leave it out. And this very conveniently brings you up to leave Y and Z for the North Pole on the polar stereographic. Okay, so we can talk about the first designations as big chunks of territory, and we fall into 11S. Now that's not 11 South like it was in the civilian system. It's 11S is our block, 8 degrees of longitude wide by 6 degrees of latitude high. Okay, here's the zone designations over the United States right off the website. As you can see, each one of them covers quite a considerable amount of territory, quite a bit of real estate, so we're going to have to divide up again within those numbers. Okay, this is how we divide it up within the numbers. We start with, there's our number and letter system, so I'm going to start with zone 18, sub-designation T, which actually is where New York City is located. Then we take it off and we divide it up into these 100,000 kilometer blocks, which we also assign letter designations to in exactly the same way. Okay, in other words, we leave out A and B, and we start lettering off, leaving out I and O, but when we get to Z, we start over again at C. Okay, that way and that way. So there's B, C, D, E, F, G, H, missing I, J, K, and so on. Okay. So now we give a second pair of numbers that bring us down to a single rectangle that's 100,000 kilometers in size, 100,000 meters, or 100 kilometers by 100 kilometers. So the designation 18TWC, unfortunate designation, but there you are, brings us down to a chunk of Earth that we can then start putting grid references to like this. Okay, so we can go over this, in this case, 87 units in X and 13 units in Y, and we interleave X and Y together. We always have to have an even number here, but they go in pairs, X then Y for this. So and now we've got down to this point, 18TWC8713 takes us down to 1 kilometer square. That's because we've got 2 units there and we're in hundreds of thousands of meters within each block. Brings us down to a smaller location. That's big enough to, say, you know, do much of Midtown Manhattan. Okay, here's an example of drilling the system down. As I said, one of the advantages is we can support multiple levels of resolution with these systems. And this system allows us to drill all the way down. So this is designations within a grid zone, or grid zone designations, as the military likes to call them. So we can start with a cell like 4Q, that's UTM zone 4, big cell, 6 degrees wide Q, go to the 100,000 meter blocks, it's all in the book. We go down to another letter designation, 4QFJ, now we're down to a 100 square kilometer designation. Now we start adding digits, so if we add one digit, we're at 10 kilometers. We go add 2 digits each, 1, 2 as the X, 6, 7 as the Y. We're at 1 kilometer and we can keep driving down. So a designation like this, which you notice has zone number, big cell designation, 2 letters, 5 digits in X and 5 digits in Y. Now we've drilled down to 1 square meter on the Earth's surface. Okay, very accurate. Different coordinate for here versus here, because it's that precise. Okay, don't worry if it's just sort of a little bit to comprehend at this point. It is difficult. It took me several years teaching it to even be able to explain it effectively. And I don't expect you to learn it in 2 minutes, but do take a look at the book and you'll see how it works. The nice thing about that designation is that once we go beyond the first letters, okay, the two systems are identical. The civilian and the military grid reference system are identical. So if we look at his northings, like this is 4,306,000 meters, and always on the sides of topographic maps, you'll have one point where the whole grid designation is given without any abbreviation whatsoever. Here, this is because it's the lower left-hand corner of the map. You notice the 4-3 is small, the 0-6 is big. That's because the 0-6 designation is part of the military grid reference system, and we can use the same grid that we've already marked on the map for the civilian version of the UTM, we can use for the military grid reference system. Okay, same thing goes for the Eastings up there. So it's the small 3, the big 2-2. So I would expect this designation to fit with the 2-2 coming first, 07 coming second, and then linking up with all the advanced numbers that we've already had to produce. The letter designations, I mean. So let's go back to our location just off Campus Point. What have I done here? I've opened this up in something called the National Map Viewer. This is actually the old one. There's a newer one now that's even fancier. And you notice that down here in the right-hand corner, it says USNG, United States National Grid. And then it tells us that we're at, well, you can read it, it's 11SKU385271080. And that's our designation within the military grid system, precisely, down to 1 meter. Okay. But now I'll show you the subtle difference between the U.S. national grid and the military grid. Military grid uses exactly the same designation system and WGS-84. And the U.S. national grid uses exactly the same designation system as the military grid system, but NAD-83. That's the only difference. The actual difference in the whole world between those two grid systems, maximum distance is about 2 meters. Okay, so for all essential senses and purposes, they are the same thing. U.S. national grid was sort of, because it uses the NAD ellipsoid, which is better over the United States, even though it's an Earth-centered ellipsoid, is probably more accurate. Okay, so we've covered not one, but three obviously very closely related coordinate systems, all based on the transverse Mercator, all based on using the transverse Mercator 60 times with different central meridians for the zones, and then just choosing different ways of lettering off. They all end up with the last few digits being identical. And the only differences between military grid and the U.S. national grid is the ellipsoid choice. Okay, everybody nice and confused now? Let's get really complicated. There are always going to be problems with grid systems. Okay, where would you want a grid system to be most effective? Well, perhaps in the middle of a city, perhaps in the middle of somewhere where there's a great national disaster that almost destroys the city. You would like that all to fall on a single grid. Well, here's a designation going right through the middle of New Orleans. Okay, this is actually the big canal there. Lower Ninth is over that way. So this part is designation 15RYP, and this one that falls in the next zone bound, next zone entirely, 16RBJ or U. Can't quite see that. Enormous difference between the two values just by going a couple of blocks in the middle of New Orleans. Okay. So this is a distinct disadvantage of grid systems. We would like one area, you know, Southern California, Los Angeles Basin, all to have the same grid designation, at least for the first few digits, but in fact, at least in the case of New Orleans, it isn't. And of course, this created all sorts of havoc in the emergency response after Hurricane Katrina. All right. Just when you thought it was safe to close your book and that you'd learned everything there was to learn about grid systems, let me introduce you to one of the more complicated systems. Okay. It being complicated, I'll also point out that it's reasonably accurate, and also it's almost universally used by the surveying and engineering industries in the United States. Okay, so it's a very important one to know. So, important things to know about the state plane coordinate system. It's a single system, but it works only in the United States and the U.S. territories, and not particularly well in Alaska. The old system, the old version of the state plane coordinate system, was based on NAD-27, and its units were in feet. Okay? And of course, maps being usually fairly old, it's usually marked on topographic maps in feet. That's why I'm going through the two versions for you. Okay? After NAD-83 came along, and we had a much better reference ellipsoid that was Earth-centered rather than based on Meade's Ranch, and GRS-80, which is, again, Earth-centered, they decided to change the zones around a little bit to make them more logical and to use meters instead of feet. Okay, the biggest change for California in this switch to NAD-83 is we lost a zone. Los Angeles County used to be its own zone, but it disappeared after this switch. Each state works independently, and each state is going to be drawn multiple times on different map projections. Not different map projections. They're going to stick with one projection for each state, but they're going to change the focal point, the convergence point, the tangent point for each projection in each state. Now, as a result of all this switching around and changing projections, mostly by using a different projection for states that are elongated east-west versus north-south, or other zones like that, it's more accurate than UTM. So we're talking about one part in about 10,000 here, much more precise, more accurate for engineering and surveying. And all the data that I've got that I've worked with campus planning and so on for the campus is all in this system. Okay, this is what the zones look like for the United States. This is after the rationalization here. You'll see that California has five zones. Texas has five zones, but they're designated a little bit differently. Montana decided to go with a single zone for the whole state. Hawaii has only one zone, it's not that huge. We've got very unusual looking zones for Alaska. Some other states split into only two zones. Lucky Vermont, New Hampshire, and Rhode Island managed to do it without more than one zone. Here's the state plane zones for California. These zones are, generally speaking, designed to follow county boundaries. Okay, so a county surveyor would be licensed and certified to use the system within the county in most cases, or even though it's state level licensure. Okay, so we've got six zones for the state. As it says, LA County was zone 7 on NAD-27, but it got folded into zone 5, which is our zone. We're here in zone 5 in Santa Barbara County, right over here. Okay. How are the zones divided up? And more importantly, how are they going to be projected? Well, here are two very different examples. States that are, generally speaking, taller than they are wide get divided up laterally, like that. And when you've got a long, thin strip running north-south, we already know the transverse Mercator projection is a good choice because it's going to minimize error going north-south along the land. So in this case, we split the boundaries up into three zones. Unfortunately, we crossed between UTM zones 12 and 13 in spanning the state, but we live with that. And then we follow county boundaries. You notice, though, there are counties like this county. If you're here in this county, you're in a different zone and a different system than the one just north of you. Opposite compensation, you might say. If we've got a state like Texas, which has a lot of east-west extent, then we know that by having a Lambert conformal conic with two standard parallels, we can put the parallels exactly where we want them. If we put them, say, for Texas south, we can put one here and one here, and we'd minimize the distortion within that zone to a great degree, and then draw it in the Lambert conformal conic projection. Okay, we use the same projection for each zone, but we re-center the projection as we move from zone to zone. And then we need eastings and northings, exactly the way we did with UTM. We do it like this. Formerly, some number of feet west and south of the zone edge was used. Often it was 2 million feet to the left of the zone. But each zone is different, so the best advice I can do is say Google it, because each one has an individual reference point that you'll have to find. And then, of course, the origin points changed slightly when they were converted to metric, and the offsets for the new origins are given in feet. I don't understand the logic of that one at all. But here's an example from Georgia. So Georgia is a transverse Mercator state. Okay, so Georgia West Zone, it has what's called a FIPS code, so its state designation and its county and zone designation are all standardized by the federal government. So this zone is going to include Atlanta. The latitude of the origin is 30 degrees north. I left out the end there. The longitude of the and origin of the central meridian is at this position here, 84.10 west. The datum is NAD83. And we've changed the scale factor. We've made it slightly different to make it secant. So we've got more than one standard parallel for the zone. Okay, this gives us a false northing at the origin of zero and a false easting of the origin at 700,000 meters. And then we can just use them like X and Y from there on. Sounds confusing, but it's not too bad. So, for example, we can talk about Campus Point now, which has that latitude-longitude designation. We've already looked at that. That's how I opened the lecture. And we can say that on NAD83, zone 405, the FIPS standard zone for zone California zone 5, we are 602,029 meters east of the false origin for the zone, 1,830,437 meters north of the origin point for the zone. And we can also say that under the old NAD27, also designated 405, California Zone 5, now we're in millions of feet east and hundreds of thousands of feet north. These all refer to exactly the same position. Two different versions of the same state plane reference to the point. Okay. Obviously, all big numbers tend to look alike. It's hence you see the advantages of the military grid system, which uses letters for most of the case, and those letters become very different. Okay, so here's my perfect timing today. Here's my summary. Coordinate systems are good, but they're best when they're standardized. Ideally, we'd like them applied to the whole world, but they don't in many cases. We've missed out the poles, for example. Not all systems are global. We've looked at the Universal Transverse Mercator system, the civilian version, the national grid, which is the civilian version of the military grid, the military grid reference system. These are all based on the UTM system and the original 60 zone designations. We also looked at the state plane system, where the projections, state plane coordinate system, two different projections, the UTM and the Lambert conformal conic used, but partitioned up into 120 zones before the states. Here's the clincher. Often we've got coordinates in one system and we would like them in another system. So we might have latitudes and longitudes and we want UTMs. Or we might have civilian UTMs and we want military grids or national grids. So it'd be nice if there were converters around to do that. And in fact, there are. There are lots of them on the web, so you can find them yourselves and start playing with them. Okay, I'll see you all on Friday.